Now, chance to listen to the chat I had a couple of weeks ago with Craig Campbell. Craig is a Canadian comic. He's appearing at the Junction here in Cambridge on Friday evening. And you might have seen him on television. He's been on Michael McIntyre's Comedy Roadshow, Russell Howard's Good News, and Alan Davis's As Yet Untitled. He's also supported Rich Hall and Frankie Boyle on tour. So I asked him, given that he'd supported both those artists, if being the headline act, as he is this time, affects what he writes rather than being the support.
Yeah, I'm certainly more in charge of a different, you know, if you call it a show arc or a narrative. Yeah, absolutely. You know, that the position of opener in a big theater is quite separate and defined from doing two halves of 45 minutes for yourself, for example. So, you know, the first half I like to engage with people more than I might if I was, say, opening for a Rich or a Frankie, in terms of finding out who's there and, you know, maybe even finding out their names or where they live or what color their house is or what they do for a living. And you can delve into it a bit more. It's more long form, you know, and then you can in that way play with a larger palette, time and information wise, to bring things in further down the way. I think, you know, you may be aware, some people might know, that comedians call it callback, for example. Sometimes it's a device that, you know, people are used to recall information that was used earlier in the show, and people quite enjoy it if you remember that their name was Dave 40 minutes after you first asked it, and wink at them if something might be specific to them that just came out of your mouth. So, you know, things like that you don't have a chance to do when you're doing 15 minutes, say 20 minutes, in front of a bigger acts audience. And, you know, it's not your place to do so. It's essentially get out there, do your greatest hits, and get out of the way. I'm trying to put $94,000 in a suitcase and get the heck out of Dodge as quickly as I can. Don't go long. Keep it tight.
What do you say? Keep it tight. How much is there every night, and how much do you improvise every night?
I try not to go to script for as long as possible. So for me, that, you know, that's the bit that keeps you sane, I think, anyway, my own assessment of self. But repeating things that you know like the back of your hand, as though you've said it for the first time tonight to a new audience, is, you know, it's great for the audience, otherwise you wouldn't be doing it, but it's also for you, it's something that you've heard 92,000 times that week, you know. And it's just like, you have to play it by ear, of course, Lee. You have to have the sense of the intuition of knowing that they're enjoying themselves. Otherwise, you're just a guy talking, of course. So if you're getting laughs off of the hat that the person in the front row is wearing, and you've got a lot more to talk about it, and then that leads into the hat jokes that you have, or you pull a hat out of your own pocket and do a couple of faces with it, then there's no real point, you know, in telling them what you thought of Boris Johnson's take on Brexit. For me, it's like a deck of cards. You know what you can play, and it's a matter of when you can play it. If you finish the show and you know that you've got three aces still to play, that's a really nice feeling. You know that for the last 5 minutes of the set, for example, you can pull out things that you in the business you might call a banker. You know, the jokes that, you know, 99% of the time are going to really get a great reaction. So if you got your bankers in your pocket when you're having a drink after the show or on your way home in the car, you're feeling good about the night.
You have to be very quick thinking then. Do you think you have to have a special kind of brain to do what you do? You must be thinking all the time, you know, where am I in the routine? What more have I got to give?
I think somebody's assessed my schizophrenia. Oh, yeah, one of my personalities is going to have to deal with this. I think thinking outside of the box is probably, you know, you have to be decipherable to be understood, but you have to be obtuse enough to be enjoyed. You know, you can't always be outside of the box, then nobody knows what you're talking about. But if you kind of follow the narrative of what is maybe the perceived norm, and then make a hard right at the end of it to sort of create the shock and surprise that humor is born of, that's sort of the game at hand. But all these, you know, things have to be factored in of, will they understand the right turn at the end? You know, will it appear obtuse in the setting that you're in, or is that, you know, normal? That's something that you really, it's a minefield with British audiences, because in a way that isn't always the case extra-culturally in other parts of the world, that, you know, Brits are often ahead of the joke. Brits are, you know, looking for the punchline, which is something that I quite enjoy about this part of the world. You know, I'm being very generalistic to say Brits, but a lot of audience, you know, ardent audience fans in this part of the world are comedically savvy. You know, I do make mention of this, and it's something that I really cherish and enjoy about the UK, is that I notice it more pronounced when I say come back from a continental trip, like a snowboard trip to France, perhaps, or Switzerland or Norway, or these kind of places where the public theater is more staid. The public interaction has less bold comedic forays. As say, like, you know, when I first arrive after a couple of weeks in France, and the very first petrol station that I stop in Kent, the Ashford services, and I'm filling up, and the night attendant and his co-worker have the temerity and the boldness to suggest that someone who looks as I do might have his significant other in the overhead box of my vehicle, right? Like, just that kind of, like, and he's realized, ah, I forgot how funny you people are. Like, you don't even know who I am, and you're suggesting that I'm a serial killer and I've got a body hidden in my vehicle. That's a wonderful element to the culture that he's like, ah, they're looking for the joke already here. So when you're dealing with a big group of them, you know, you can't always go for the high percentage hit because they're already there. That right turn becomes a more, you know, a more pronounced right turn. It becomes a hairpin turn with a hook on it, you know. If you want to leave the audience behind and still surprise them, you've got to be that tiny bit more esoteric or, you know, or less predictable. And that, to me, you know, it's a beautiful element of British humor. It's at the extreme ends of decipherability for the culture itself. You know, it's less broad than American humor, for example. You have terminologies that don't translate across the pond, and you're proud of that. You know, you like to talk in depth about certain subjects in front of people and have them not know if you're talking about scuba diving or football. That wink, wink, nudge, nudge sort of insider trading element of British comedy is a really beautiful thing if you're, as I am, a Canadian that's privy to it. So for me, that's kind of the sneak attack. When I speak to people in like the smorgasbord or the buffet area on a boat, you know, if I'm coming across on the ferry and I'm speaking to strangers, which another thing Brits embrace and I really like doing is, today I've, you know, probably spoken to 10 people easily that I've, you know, not known before. They're engaging. But it's interesting for me when you're speaking to this sort of, you know, strange environment, like often will assume that I'm just off the boat. You know, they hear my accent and they sort of like kind of explain simple things to me. Like, hey, be careful when you get here. We're on the other side of the road. You know, you know, like, and this is, yeah, I got it. You know, like, I'm well aware of what parish you represent by your accent. And you presumptively assumed me to be, you know, some numbskull from the middle of America, you know, somewhere, and clearly on my first visit to the castle or whatever they've got going on in their own head. So I kind of, you know, I like to play that. I'm a bit of an informed plant. You know, it works also the other direction when they realize, oh, this guy's not actually just off the boat. Then it becomes a much richer conversation with, you know, much more tapestry to it because they become broader. It's one of the things I most actually enjoy about this part of the world, when the broadness is enhanced. Like, you may be aware in radio, or that they've just been doing a study that wonderfully confirms what everybody assumed, is that Scottish people actually do scientifically speak more broadly. Glaswegians in particular speak more broadly when they're speaking to a tourist, right? Like, something that everybody always thought, like, why do they become more indecipherable when somebody who isn't Glaswegian is around? And they now know that it's utterly, you know, being picked apart, the fine-tooth comb, to figure out why it is that certain Brits, particularly Glaswegians, do that. And I like that. I like it when, you know, Brits sort of embrace themselves and become, you know, deep Yorkshire, or, you know, become their Northumberland roots. And, you know, yeah, I was just earlier today speaking to the Black Country, you know, the Wolverhampton accent. These are things that I really, you know, appreciate. Devon, for example, the real Devonshire accent, which is becoming more rare. You know, the estuary English taking over the UK, it makes you re-embrace this more parochial elements of it. So I like that as well, because my experience here is, you know, a bit more vast than most are used to. I think I've maybe in the last couple of years been here now for half of my life.
I suppose it's complex in a way for you because you understand British humour and you're plugging into that. But do you find that British audiences are looking for you as a Canadian to bring something different as well?
I think sometimes, yeah, it's harder to put a finger on that. But maybe if I use an analogy, for example, there might be an element of this analogy in my relationship with the British public. For example, I lived in Holland for a number of years and quite enjoy, you know, that part of the world that I often visit. You know, another great element for me as a Canadian who lives in the UK is I don't just live in the UK, I live in Europe. So for me to be able to, you know, go visit World War One battlefields, you know, that my relatives have experienced on my way to snowboarding in Austria is a pretty, like, you know, wow. How's England? It's awesome! You know, like, I'm loving it! But, you know, when I go to somewhere like Holland that I'm so familiar with, and I go up on stage and I do, you know, I can talk literally for days on the uniqueness of the Dutch culture as an outsider looking in and as somebody, you know, kind of adapting myself to living among them, that they'll come up to me often after the show, not often, but certainly have done several times, and just said, you know, we really, you know, we wanted to see your Canadian jokes. you're telling us all about ourselves. We know quite a bit about that, but we didn't really bring you all the way from Canada to hear about what we were wearing on a Tuesday, you know. I use this only as an analogy. I don't know if there's an element of that with the British audience, but maybe it's there, you know, it could be. I don't know how much the audience is coming with an expectation, which actually is another great element, the sneak attack of, I bring this up very, very often on stage, that Brits very often can't put their finger on Canadians. In fact, like I mentioned earlier today, I work, just because of, you know, the entertainment business that I'm in, I'm variously working with impressionists, people who make their bread and butter actually imitating actual voices to the potential defeat if they're not accurately depicted. And I always put them on the spot and have yet to have one perform a good Canadian accent. It's just one of those, you know, it's whether or not the Brits themselves don't have enough of an elemental idea of what a quintessential Canadian is. Maybe it's because the diversity of Canada, starting with the fact that our rich tapestry is begun with a massive French province right in the middle of us, who are also as Canadian as I am. So maybe it's the diversity of the country that makes it hard to imitate an actual, like, you know, an expected norm of that part of the world. But the fact is that they just crank out a couple of syllables and then just sadly start to look at their feet as they realize they just did somebody from Brooklyn. You know, it's just that, like, I'm being an American now. There's that, like, utter defeat. Maybe this is a challenge to impressionists. Like, I met, to give the diversity of the festival, in about 1995, I met a wonderful actress from Manchester. This is as far as it went, by the way. It's not a body story, by the way. But I met a wonderfully talented Manchester actress who did a mind-blowing Canadian accent. Whether or not she had relatives or maybe a close friend that was, you know, the typical Torontonian accent. But it was a real, like, it gave me shivers up my spine. I was just like, wow! Wow, you can do it, because it's such a splitting hairs type of thing. But it would be as obtuse, you know, as me trying to do a Brummy accent for a black country person and have them just look woefully at their feet, realizing that I was just butchering what I had as an impression of them. It's that kind of nuance to it.
Can you do a Brummy accent? No.
I can tell you this. Speaking earlier today, I had the confusion with a Brummy in a festival in Herefordshire in the middle of nowhere. Only in the diversity of a British festival could this possibly happen. I was meeting up with the promoter pre-show in a muddy field, and he was telling me implicitly, making it clear to me, that he was on the blue couch. And there's a horrible accent, but it's the blue couch. And I was like, okay, I'll find you on the blue couch. And I found, of course, the blue couch, which for me was unbelievably, being that you can only imagine the craziness of this festival, that in the green room, outdoor green room area in this muddy field, there was a blue Chesterfield, which for me, of course, is the blue couch. And I sat on it and called this man through horrible reception, thank you, O2, ad nauseum, trying to get a clear enough connection to tell him, I'm on the blue couch, where are you? And he kept saying, I'm on the blue couch. Like, you can't be. It's not that big a couch. I'm on it myself. And, of course, it was the realization that right beside where I was a blue bus, the coach. Uh-huh. And he was on it as a Brummy. And I just never could anything be that complicated that was intended to be so simple as meeting somebody on the blue coach. I never would have guessed that this man was on a blue bus while I was actually able to find in a muddy field a blue Chesterfield.
I was going to say, what are the odds on that? That is unlucky.
It's madness. And, you know, but that's why, you know, I love, you know, interacting with the Brits, because I think, how did we ever fight wars together? How is it ever possible that we ever understood each other enough to, like, I said grenades! What the hell are you doing? Why do you have a box of oranges at the front? You know, it's just, to me, just such a difficult understanding. But I, you know, I love it. I love the challenge of it. It's still fresh to me. I still feel like I'm on holiday every day. I'd now take side routes to get to my different venues, and if I have the time, I'll check my walking route out on the sat nav and see if I can take the slowest route. In fact, if anybody out there is an application pro or a programmer, I've wanted to, if anybody wants to make $1 billion, I thought that you should have a button to push on your sat nav that gives you the most scenic route.
Oh, that's a good idea.
I can't believe that if it doesn't exist, I can't believe that it doesn't yet. They're just like, hey, I've got all day. I'd like to go the pretty way. And so for me, that's, you know, often the walking route. I'll do, you know, at the same time you're driving through the middle of people's homes. That's one of my favorite things about the UK. You built your houses before you built your roads. I love it, you know, when you're driving through Dorset and you have to, like, pass through somebody's kitchen on your way to the next highway. Like, sorry, something interrupts your dinner there, you know, trying to push the back end of your car around the corner of the building that's forced itself into the middle of the road. And, you know, these things are just, I know it's every day for you, but it's still inspiring for me.
You must have been across the M62. There's a house right in the middle of six lanes of motorway because the guy refused to sell.
Well, like so many things in my life, I know that through comedians' jokes. That's one of my favorite, you know, that people are like, do you watch the news? No, I just watch current event comedians and see exactly what's going on. And that was probably one of the first things I'd ever heard in a Mancunian accent, was that crazy guy in the middle of the M62. I, of course, at the same time, was like, I wonder if the M62 is a local snack. You know, like, why would a man live in a box of crackers? I wonder what, you know, at the same time trying to piece together, you know, everything. You can only imagine how complicated from the ground up the UK is, you know, for somebody from the hinterland of Canada. It's a minefield, to say the least.
It's lovely talking to you. You run at quite a speed, Craig. Do you ever slow down? Is there a quiet, shy person underneath there?
No, pretty rarely. I'm in the throes right now. It's the preparation, oddly, that is this far away, of the Edinburgh PR press, all the things that you have to write out to tell people what your show is and where it's going to be. So I'm actually in quite a comedically fertile mind, and I'm really enjoying that. I take in sort of information at night. I do a lot of reading on the side, but I'm also, you know, in the mid of a tour with Frankie Boyle, so I'm so lucky to be in front of such large audiences on a very regular basis. It's essentially, you know, Wednesday to Saturday, and now my own tour just began last week, Saturday, in Tiverton, and now I'm interspersing my own dates with the Frankie tour. So this is, you know, dovetailing into a tour that ended in the middle of February that was a snowboard comedy tour across Canada from January into February, and that's like 35 shows over 30 nights. It's a wonderful place to be, Lee, where you're just, I'm performing a lot. I'm in a place where, like, very much like we're doing now, where, you know, people are like, hey, what is it about this or that that you're interested in? And I got a story for it, because that's, you know, it's my job to do so. So I quite like being in this mindset. I can get into periods of relaxation, but as a comedian or a performer, you realize your muscle is getting flabby, and you know, you want to get it back to sharp as quick as possible. And I guess then the next fear is overperforming, which, you know, back to our earlier conversation when you talked about, do you work with the audience, or do you, you know, go to your script right away? That's another reason why I like to sort of stay in the ethereal for as long as possible, because it keeps you sane. It keeps you, once you've told a joke so many times in a row, it really, you know, that you talk to any performer that's finished a tour, for example, and they just don't want to hear it again. They don't want to see it again. They don't want it referenced. And it can become like something that's too close to you for too long. So I like to actually get on the fringes of forgetting the show and then re-remembering. And it's quite a wonderful experience when you're like telling a story again and then in your own head. It's so wonderful how diverse our minds are, in terms of you can be thinking about what you had for dinner while you're telling a joke, while you're setting up the next couple of jokes, while you're looking out of the corner of your eye to see what time it is so that you can end the interval at the right time. You know, and think about, oh, I wouldn't mind a juice when I get to the green room. That'd be interesting as well. But all these things are going on. And at the same time, you're like re-remembering, why do I even tell this story? You're like reflecting on yourself while you're telling the story. Just thinking, I bet there's some big punchline at the end of it that gives this whole thing a reason for being. And then you, of course, you know, in the mid of it, oh, yeah, right. Oh, I fell in the pool. I totally forgot that. And then it's quite nice because, you know, you got far enough away from the story or the joke in this sense that you think, oh, that's why it's funny. Okay. And then, you know, that kind of fuels your own reaction, your acting part of the performance. It gives inspiration to shaping what reaction you want the audience to give that's an honest depiction of how you felt at the time. That's sort of like, you know, people talk about reliving it as it happened, you know, making it seem like it's there for the first time. And I really like that process. I like just getting it far enough away, and then when I'm reliving it on stage, just getting back to, oh, and often through that, you'll find new punchlines. You'll look at it from that slightly different half a millimeter or a couple of degrees off perspective. And then it's just like a new line comes out of nowhere. And then in our line of work, that's bread and butter, right? Sometimes, you know, 5 years in, all of a sudden a joke reaches its potential. And, you know, and then you just think, why did I do it on Michael McIntyre's Roadshow 4 years ago when it's so much funnier now? That's kind of, you know, our life, a little look into the madness of comedy world.
Craig Campbell. I had about 10 questions. I think I got through about four. He's a funny guy. He's on at the Junction on Friday night. If you want to get tickets for that, the Junction website, junction.co.uk. Oh, we're running a little bit late. It's 11:46.
Jess Levin from Macmillan Cancer Support is joining me on the line now to talk to us all of things Macmillan and things like that. So a very good afternoon to you, Jess. Thank you very much for joining me on Cambridge 105 today.
Thank you for having me, Matt. It's good to be here.
No problem at all. So starting off with a couple of things to update us all from the last time that one of your colleagues came in. First of all, how are things going with the new Macmillan Woodland Centre?
Yes, it's going really well with the new Macmillan Woodland Centre. We're still fundraising, so we've still got a long way to go, but we've had some fantastic support from the community over a year now we've been running the appeal. So it's going really well, and we hope that the new centre will be up and running by the end of the year.
So what does the new centre offer people?
So it's basically increasing capacity of the centre. So the current capacity at the centre was just completely overstretched, and we knew that the number of people needing treatment at the centre was going to double by this year. So we really needed to do something to make the centre larger so that people would have that choice of local treatment. One example is that the current centre has 9 chemotherapy chairs, so the new centre will have 15 chemotherapy chairs and 2 private rooms for treatment.
That's good stuff, though, that obviously you're getting the fundraising coming in and obviously people supporting you. If someone does want to donate some money and perhaps they've received support from Macmillan or maybe a loved one has, how would they go about doing that?
So they can contact our fundraising support centre. We'd love to hear from anyone who's keen to either donate some money, do a fundraising event. We love hearing about all the wacky ideas that people have. So if you can contact us on 0300 1000 or alternatively you can email us on fundraising@macmillan.org.uk.
And speaking of fundraising initiatives and activities, what have you been up to since December? Because there must have been quite a bit happening in and around the local area.
Yes, well, we've had lots happening. We've had fashion shows, we've had people running marathons for us, and we've got lots planned for the summer as well. So it's going to be a really busy few months to come.
And what sort of things have you got coming up in the summer months then?
So we've got RAF Witten Voluntary Band are doing a concert for us 7th of May. So tickets are available for that. And so that's going to be a great night of all different music. We've got other events. We've got Fringe in the Fen this year, which is the 7th of 10th to in July. And that's basically a classical musical festival with all different events going on across the 3 days. So that's going to be really exciting. And for those who want to get on their bikes, we've got Bromswold Bike Fest on Saturday the 11th of June, and that's in Leighton Bromswold. It's a family day with a barbecue and also lots of different cycle routes. So we've got anything from 2 miles to 70 miles. So there's no excuse not to get on the bike.
Absolutely. And when it comes to the Macmillan World's Biggest Coffee Morning, I received a reminder in the post with a couple of post-it notes to put the date in people's diaries about that's coming up. It comes up in September, doesn't it?
Yes, so September 30th, we've got our World's Biggest Coffee Morning again. So it's in its 26th year now. So it's fantastic to see everyone get involved. So that's a really great event where you can just bake some cakes and serve coffee. And it's a really great way to support Macmillan. So we'd love to get as many people involved in that and make it again the world's biggest.
And other things that you're looking for at the moment, I've seen it on the Macmillan website, you're still looking for volunteers to come and help at events and help raise funds, more importantly.
Yes, definitely. So we'd love to hear from anyone who would like to support Macmillan, whether that's helping at any of our events in the area or whether they'd like to hold their own fundraising event. So as I mentioned before, if anyone is interested or would like to find out a bit more about how they can get involved, we'd love to chat to you on 0300 1200.
Well, Jess, it's been fantastic catching up with you, and it sounds like you've had a busy couple of months, and it looks like the next couple of months over the summertime are going to be really busy as well. Looking forward to hearing from you in a couple of months' time to update us on how those activities have been going on.
Thank you so much for having me on, Matt, and also just a big thank you to the community who's got behind our appeal and who donates to Macmillan. It's fantastic to have such great support in the area.
Thank you very much. That's Jess Levin from Macmillan Cancer Support. Thank you very much for joining me on Cambridge 105 today. Thank you.
Thank you.
my guest this afternoon. She is the Mill Road coordinator, Franny Ritchie. Afternoon.
Hi, Matt.
So lots of busy things happening around Mill Road, and one big thing that's coming up is the Mill Road Midsummer Events.
That is a big thing, yes. It's on July 2nd, 2nd of July, from 5 to 10 p.m.
So really tell us about what's happening, because it sounds really exciting. I've seen a few little snippets in the media about it.
Yeah, we've had 1,000 people register their interest on Facebook already, which was a little victory. So what we're envisioning is a summer counterpart to the Winter Fair. And last year, there was a small festival, kind of a zero-year pilot project. It was 3 or 4 venues up and down Mill Road, and some of the traders got involved in special evening events as well. What we're doing this year is basically just sort of a natural progression. It was last year in year zero. Guider Street Car Park was a food festival. Barat Bavan, the old Mill Road Public Library in the corner of the bridge, was sort of a vintage and craft market. And then Ash Coop, just the other side, the Romsey side of Mill Road Bridge, was sort of music and entertainment. A lot of the residents of the co-op came and performed, and I think Argo Iris was there, and the Capoeira group, the Cambridge Capoeira group, was there as well. So it was sort of, it was a real mix of things. This year we're looking at adding a couple of venues. We're looking at adding sort of a young person's chill-out area next to Dale's Brewery, across the street from the food festival. And we're looking at adding a new sort of family-friendly creative space in Ditchburn Place. And then there are a few other things that are in the works as well.
It sounds really exciting, actually. I mean, I've looked at some of the things that are going to be held. There's going to be an art and craft section, and there's going to be, as you say, live entertainment. And there's going to be food, which is always a good attractive thing to have.
And drinks, yeah.
So when it comes to sort of like putting an event like this together, it must be quite a lot of hard work, because you have to get from the planning stage to the implementation and then it actually happening. So how does the process actually, how does it actually work?
Yeah, well, so we started in November for a festival in July, and we've got a really great committee. There's been, you know, some people coming and going, but we've, particularly lately, we've had a lot of people kind of coming out of the woodwork saying they want to be involved. At this point, we're meeting about once a month. We're working with, for example, the manager of Ditchburn Place to make sure that she's on board with everything that we're thinking and trying not to get too carried away. The hardest thing, actually, has been that we kind of maxed out a lot of the obvious open spaces. We decided not to go for a road closure. That was something that was, you know, we went back and forth on a lot. And ultimately, we decided we just didn't have the resources this year. So that's hopefully a 2017-18 goal. But yeah, it'll ultimately have been about a 7 or 8 month process. We're hoping on the day to get about 5,000 people. More would be great. And as I said, it's a committee probably of about 7 or 8 people who have been there since the beginning, with support from people like Laura Wilderspin at Ditchburn Place and a number of other local residents. And the thing, of course, that I have to say is that we've got core sponsorship from Prana Indian Restaurant, and they have been just so generous. We're so excited. Last year, there was no sponsorship at all. The event just about broke even. And so we've really got some opportunities to expand and to try some new things here.
But there's also additional sponsorship from Anglia Ruskin University as well, which is a really good thing to have.
Yeah. Yeah, we've been really lucky. A number of local traders and businesses have been really generous. And you should definitely look at our website to see the full list.
Yes, there's quite a lot happening. Are people still able to register for stalls and to have a presence there on the day?
Yeah, so at this point, we're waiting to hear back on how many stalls we'll have. The Guider Street car park has essentially been filled. We did a call out a few weeks ago. We're waiting to hear about, for example, the space outside St. Barnabas Church. If we get that, yeah, then definitely get in touch. We'll have space for 10 or 15 more stalls then. If not, fingers crossed for next year. So I guess the answer is it's kind of a moving target, and it can't hurt to try.
Excellent stuff. So that's taking place on Saturday, the 2nd of July, from 5 till 10 p.m. A few other things happening on Mill Road. There's a few businesses we're saying goodbye to, and one of them is Cambridge Resale, which has been on Mill Road for some considerable years now.
Yeah, so they're still going to be an entity. They're still a going concern, but they've moved the business entirely online, and I think they'll be focusing specifically on eBay. So if you can't get enough Cambridge Resale in your life, you know where to find them. But unfortunately, you can't find them on Mill Road anymore.
I will give them a small plug, because they're having a small closing down sale until the end of April at the moment.
Yes.
They've got it advertised on their window. So if you do want to sort of pop in and get some bits and pieces while you can, it's probably wise to do so over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, before all the treasures are gone.
Yes, and you can meet one of our presenters, Paul Cristoforo, who actually works in the shop as well. So hopefully, Paul, if you're listening, you'll find somewhere else to work very soon. So some other things that are happening. There's a few buildings that are being renovated and proposing to have some new businesses in them as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Cambridge Classic Footwear, rather, is another... Oh my goodness, Cavendish Classic Footwear. Cambridge Classics is a different, wonderful business, but different
altogether.
It's a wooden
double-glazed windows
yeah,
company.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Cavendish Classics Footwear has closed down now last week. They were specialty footwear and shoe repair. And the shoe repair, thankfully, has moved over to Mill Road Home and Garden just down the street. The building itself is going to be a new hair salon. So Mill Road is increasingly the place to go in Cambridge to have your hair cut, and there will be another place to do it.
There's men's hairdressers down on Mill Road, isn't there?
There are about 15 hairdressers on Mill Road.
I'm trying to think of the one that's what it's called. It's got an orange front.
I'm not sure I could name them all, but yeah, there's definitely we're spoiled for choice. And yeah, there's clearly more demand. I think actually there's a shortage of individual salons are always looking for people. There's going to be another salon where Cavendish Classics was.
Excellent stuff. Is there anything else coming up that we should know about?
In terms of new businesses, well, I mean the sign that had the Cam Cab has the Cam Cab logo. That's going to be a Lebanese restaurant sometime this spring. I don't have specific dates. And the hoardings, the white hoardings up in front of between the Chinese supermarket and Petersfield Pharmacy, that should be finished kind of any day now.
Down towards the Donkey Common end, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't know if they have a tenant for that, but it's going to be a small shop on the ground floor and a flat up above. And when I spoke to the contractor a couple months ago, he was thinking this week was the week. And of course, the big thing that happened in the last month is that the Sainsbury's opened on the 10th of March. And speaking to some of the other traders, they said, actually, it's so far, Sainsbury's has been an incredible neighbor. And now that the shop is opened, they haven't necessarily seen any changes in their trading patterns. I think Garden Kitchen said they'd sold a few less croissants. That was it.
Because there's quite a lot of competition now. You've got the local traders alongside Tesco's and now Sainsbury's. So do you think there's enough room for all these sort of businesses that are selling produce like that?
You know, I think they're complementary. Even in the 3 weeks that Sainsbury's has been open, I've shopped at one place for my fruit, and then I've got bread from another place, and then I got cheese in another place. So, and I think specifically when you look at the businesses immediately adjacent to Sainsbury's, the new building, what you do see is a totally different sort of culinary offering, right? What you get at Culinaris is not what you get at Garden Kitchen, is not what you get at Sainsbury's, but together, I mean, that's fantastic. You couldn't ask for anything more. And I think that's also true. You know, Elamine has some real specialty produce or specialty products, rather, that do draw people from the region, not just from Romsey or Petersfield. Mm. Sainsbury's doesn't have that kind of power, but you know, not our local Sainsbury's, but it's an amenity that will, I think, supplement and complement the things that are already there.
Okay, and one other thing it's worth pointing out, obviously, is that you do have the Mill Road Traders Association.
Mm-hmm.
Any updates from those guys?
Yeah, we've had a few new businesses join the Traders Association. The big thing happening with the Traders Association is that we're in the midst of elections for a new chair. In the past, we've had a chair and two vice chairs, and we're flipping it. So going forward, we're going to have two chairs and a vice chair. Piero D'Angelico, who is of Piero's Hair Salon, who has been the chair, is now going to be the vice chair. And we've got two new people coming in, currently being in the process of being elected as chairs. And that's Matt Williams of Timber Tech Construction and Shapur Mehta of Cantab Millennium.
Excellent stuff. So mm-hmm. It's all very, very busy along Mill Road at the moment.
And actually, the other thing worth noting about the Traders Association is that the last three people we've had join are not traders that you might be familiar with from walking up and down Mill Road. They're actually home-based businesses. So Forever Living, which is a skincare and sort of aloe-based product company that uses direct marketing. We've got a representative on Mill Road, and she joined recently. There's a nail technician who works from home and does parties and events. She joined recently. And Martha Rosie Bakes, which is a bakery as you might imagine, that is actually already supplying a number of cafes up and down the road that she joined recently as well. So really, you know, it's really nice that we have a chance to highlight people who aren't necessarily visible via storefronts.
Well, the 10 minutes has whizzed by, as it always does. But of course, if someone wants to get in contact with you to find out more about what you do, and more importantly, if they want to get involved in Milroy, perhaps they live in one of the flats above one of the shops, how would they go about contacting you?
The best way is always milroadcoordinator@gmail.com. But you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram as well.
Excellent stuff. Franny, it's been fantastic talking to you, and we'll talk to you again in a month's time. And maybe we'll do a bit of a focus on some of the charity shops on Mill Road, because there's quite a few down there that don't often get a lot of publicity. So maybe we'll sort of touch upon those next time.
That'd be great. Thanks for having me.
Excellent stuff. Thank you.
Welcome today, my guests, Edward Lee and Penny Heath from Smarter Cambridge Transport, an association comprising residents from around Cambridge and South Cambridgeshire. Good morning, both of you.
Good morning, Susie.
Oh, very nice to have you here. Thank you very much indeed. So would you like to just give us an intro into Smarter Cambridge and what it's all about? Who would like to start? I assume Edward would like to start that one.
Thank you, Susie. Yeah, we started in September last year. It was really prompted by the city deal, the announcement of up to, well, at the time, £500 million pounds to spend on improving the infrastructure, the transport infrastructure in the region. And this seemed to be a fantastic opportunity to perhaps sort of plug some of the gaps in the development that has happened over the last few decades, and to really really improve the transport infrastructure that's available to people in South Cambridgeshire and the city. And when we saw that the first proposals that came out from the County Council were essentially to build more bus lanes in the city, I think a lot of us has felt that's not the right thing to be doing in the 21st century. You know, we should be looking at smarter, using more technology, and really looking at why it is that, for instance, bus services are not as popular as they need to be. And when it, you know, it comes down to actually it's behaviour, it's psychology, and engineering is a rather crude way of getting people to change their behaviour. And actually, we should be looking really at how we can change behaviour directly. You know, why it is that bus services are not attractive, why people don't like using them. And bus lanes is might be part of the mix, but it's quite a marginal benefit, and there are lots of other things we could be doing that would provide much more benefit for people. And that's really what we wanted to set about investigating, researching, and then explaining to people what we could be doing that would be different, and that we're getting people excited about that.
Yes, definitely excited about improving Cambridge Transport. That's got to be a first. So when you say you want to improve bus lanes, or you want to halt more bus lanes happening, or you want to improve what's there already, because for me personally, I from when I was growing up in London and looking and taking a bus in Cambridge, it's fantastic the way everything is all digital, and you know when the bus is arriving, you know when it's leaving. That has improved greatly, hasn't it? But you think it's still not working here in Cambridge as much as you think most people would like it to be?
Well, unfortunately not, partly because of congestion in the city, particularly on, say, Hills Road. Journeys along that road, you know, both for private vehicles and for buses, can take 45 minutes. And that's that's not going to be solved by building another bus lane. That's only going to be solved by persuading more people to get out of their cars and either take the bus or cycle or walk or take the train. And it's really looking to try to get to the heart of the problem rather than trying to treat some of the symptoms, which I think bus lanes really are. That's all they're really doing is trying to treat a symptom.
So how are you going about doing this now? Smarter Cambridge Transport has started out in September last year, is that right?
That's right.
And that's quite a short time, but I think you've made big progress in the sense you've got a big community involved in this, haven't you? Including obviously Penny here.
Yes, and I'd say I was attracted to listening to Edward and Smarter Cambridge Transport because I love its sort of independence of thinking, and it's very much residents and people-based as opposed to lots of policy and engineering solutions first. So it's very much a listening organisation, and it adapts as it goes along, and sort of it's a real debating forum. You know, you can present any argument and something will be flushed out at the end, hopefully for a better solution for Cambridge Transport.
And actually, you've said the key word, isn't it? Listening to local people here that use the transport, use buses, use trains, have to commute all the time. And I mean, I have to say, the last 2 weeks coming into Cambridge has been absolutely bliss because there's hardly anybody on the roads, is there, at the moment? But of course, that's not realistic, is it, really?
Well, that's partly the difference between term time and holiday time.
Yes.
And unfortunately, you know, parents end up getting blamed for causing the congestion. But all that actually proves is that a difference of actually between 5 and 15% in the traffic is what makes a difference between, you know, free flowing traffic and congested gridlock traffic.
Yes, I think it's really important that it's so easy to blame the school run and the parents, but actually it's about the university and colleges and all the faculties over Easter holidays.
Absolutely.
And it's just reducing it by actually quite small amounts, which would make a difference.
Mm.
Slightly one of the arguments for bus lanes are not necessary. There are other solutions to reducing traffic.
Yes. So, and the focus on the moment is the parking controls. That's one of your focuses, is that right? Do you want to tell us about that, Edward?
It is. You know, we've done some sort of analysis of all the different measures one could take to improve traffic flows and induce what's called modal shift, where people change their mode of transport. And the thing that scores most highly in terms of having the greatest benefit for the least impact, and particularly in terms of environmental impact, is parking controls. It's actually not allowing people to drive into the city and park for free, particularly to go to work, but you know, also to come in and shop and so on.
Mm.
You know, there are lots of streets around Cambridge which are essentially free car parks, and they compete with park and ride. They compete with rural bus services, and so people who have got a car can end up taking advantage of this privilege of being able to park on a city street for free, and people who don't have a car now have to pay more to travel because bus fares have gone up and there's now a £1 charge to park at the park and ride. So I think what we need to do is involve people throughout the city in a discussion about what sort of controls are appropriate for their area to make sure that it doesn't massively inconvenience residents, unnecessarily inconvenience residents, and certainly doesn't in any way jeopardise local businesses. And there's lots of lots of types of controls that can be used. It's not a one size fits all, and the sort of residence parking controls that we have in the city centre are not appropriate for further out. And hopefully, a lighter touch would be cheaper to implement and would be more welcomed by residents. And if we do that, and we have fewer people driving into the city, that reduces congestion, it reduces pollution, and it also provides more incentive for people to use park and ride and bus services.
Yes, you're right, because all those work together, but in the right way and more cohesive to everybody else. Well, now, when you say involve in discussions, how are you going to get more people involved in this? How would you like to get people?
We've written a paper that sort of sets out how we think it should be implemented, and it's very much about consultation, and we've suggested that the parking controls should be trialled. And now councillors are saying, well, we need a demonstration of support for this. So we've set up a petition, and it's not a adversarial condition, petition. It's simply asking people to state their support and to call on councillors to consider all the options, not to rule anything out. So there's a petition. It was launched yesterday. There's on our website. There's a page which just sets out. There's a link to the petition. There's also a form where people can write to their local councillor, and they can tweet about it and so on. And we just need to get the word out. I mean, we just need to say, look, here is an option. It's different from what's been discussed before. You know, it's when it's been debated before, it's very often been resisted by residents because they feel that it's going to cost them too much, it's going to inconvenience them too much. But there are lots of options that need to be considered. So we're not trying to say this is what we want imposed. We're saying let's open out the debate. Let's consider it as a, you know, start citywide, and let's work out where we need to have parking controls and what sort of parking controls people want. So, you know, we wanted to start the debate, and signing the petition, writing to local councillors, that will start the debate.
Yeah, it's a good point, because we all want to say something, or we're moaning about it because it is so frustrating, but actually a solution is good to talk about first of all before actually saying we don't want this and we don't want that, and actually talking about it, giving some suggestions and starting the debate in a positive way. In a positive way, Penny, can I come on to you? Because you're very interesting about, you are obviously striving for keeping the natural and heritage in the city. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, I think, again, going back to a positive, the city deal, that people have really begun to sort of think about their city and quite what the implications of this enormous, you know, growth and infrastructure and traffic, transport growth is. And it's really brought home the need. We use this word environmental, and actually there's quite a lot of aspects to environment. You've got your natural environment, which is, you know, open fields and green spaces. But just as important is what we call our built heritage. And the thing that I'm particularly interested in is what I call the spaces in between, which is actually your roads and open spaces and public realm is the shorthand. And I think they say 3/4 of a city is actually made up of the roads and open spaces. It's an incredibly important part of the Cambridge experience. And I think up till now, a lot of the conservation bodies focus on what they call the historic core, you know, the old part of Cambridge, and every developer puts a picture of a King's College and a punting, you know, happy scene. But actually Cambridge is much more interesting than that, and a lot of it is the suburbs and what I would call the historic approach roads. They're very much part of the identity of the city, which link to the outskirts, to South Cambridgeshire and the villages. And I think what's upset a lot of people is that this sort of top-down city deal has come in and talked about sort of all these major roads coming into town as arterial roads and transport corridors, and actually they're all neighbourhoods, whether it's Milton Road or Romsey Mill Road or Maddingley or Barton Road. And I think people, because it's very much in the paper, is that people are really upset, you know, that people are just talking about their streets without considering the sort of visual aspect and the impact of, you know, removing trees. And it's back down to this bus lanes, you know, it's very, very invasive, and there are other ways of improving transport. So this rather heavy-handed approach, without really understanding the conservation and the value of, they call it heritage assets, but, you know, they're terribly important. And there are policies there, and the engineers know about them, but it seems to have sort of dropped to the bottom of the list.
It's a great way of getting, you know, coming, looking on your website, Smarter Cambridge website, finding out how to get involved without, I mean, petitions are great, they're fantastic, and we've all done them many, many times, haven't we, written it, but we just don't know how far they've got or how, what's the impact. But actually having something that goes with the petition, your website, to look at, to see how people can get involved. And as you say, Penny, to get involved with, no, not just the main roads, but also the outside roads and the, you know, the heritage roads. It's really important, and also for people to be listened to. And that's always been a frustration, hasn't it, for not just Cambridge, but the whole of the UK, I think. You know, we're a small island, and it's how much can we take? But from a point of view of getting people involved, can you just give us the website and what they can do to become...
The website address is smartertransport.uk, so that's smartertransport.uk, and on there are a number of papers about various aspects of transport that we've been developing. There'll be more published soon, and there's one specifically on street parking, and there's a page with just some links and actions that people can take to indicate their support.
Okay. Future things, anything you want to mention that's coming up that you would like to finish off with, Edward?
Possibly the most sort of controversial thing that we've proposed is something called inbound flow control. And this we see as being an alternative to bus lanes, specifically to get buses from the edge of the city into the city centre more freely. And it's the idea that rather than having people queue within the city where cars can block junctions and they block filter lanes and so on, that you push those queues to the edge of the city, and the buses just have to bypass that queue on the edge of the city. So on Milton Road, for instance, the bit between the A14 roundabout and the Science Park Junction is where you would queue some more vehicles and you'd have buses bypass the queue there. And this has a much, much lower environmental impact within the city. It doesn't mean that people queue longer. It's not punishing people who want to get into the city. They just queue in a different place. They queue at the outside of the city rather than in the city, where it causes a lot more problems. Conceptually, it's a very simple solution. We don't underestimate the practicalities of implementing it, but we think that if we take an attitude of, well, how could we make this work, I think we'll get a lot further than just simply saying, oh, that would be too difficult.
You've said it. How it work and not how it... That's absolutely spot on. Thank you, Edward. It's been a pleasure having both of you here, Penny and Edward. Penny Heath and Edward Lee, thank you from the Smarter Cambridge Transport. And I wish you all the best of luck. And I hope many, many people from Cambridge will get involved and make a very positive impact and debate about this. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Susie.
Thank you very much.
Stephen Leask and David Geritz.
Geritz.
Oh, I knew I'd get it wrong, even though you just told me, and I still got it wrong.
All right, everyone does it. It's fine.
Who are two of the cast of the Merley Theatre?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And travelled up from London today, or more or less. Yeah,
yeah, just outside, yeah.
Yep. But it's a couple of weeks till you come to Cambridge, is that right?
Yeah, so we're, as you said earlier, we're in Cambridge on Wednesday the 20th of April, and we've just finished, last week we just finished a short run in London, so we're on a little bit of a break, which is quite nice.
Yeah,
and it's sunny, lovely. So... going to sit outside and enjoy the sun rather than the insides of a dark theatre for once, which is nice.
So tell us all about the Merley Theatre then. What is it?
Well,
go on.
Well, in its current form, it's basically 10 actors, 5 women, 5 men, and we performing 5-hander versions of Midsummer Night's Dream and Henry V. Mm-hmm. What makes us unique and I think sort of fun to watch is the fact that we are a gender-blind company, which means you have 5 women, 5 men. We each have a male-female twin, male-female counterpart, and we share our parts. So my twin is Tamara, and we share our parts, and we'll do a play, and I'm playing a woman as well as 2 men, and she's playing 2 men as well as a woman, and we just swap in and out, and it allows us to be... allows you to see a strong woman playing Henry V, mm-hmm. or a 6-foot guy with a beard playing a woman, which is fun to play. And
well, yeah, I'm a big bloke from Newcastle, and I play Titania, Queen of the Fairies. So
more like a pantomime than a show.
No, it's not. Though. We do it very straight.
Yeah. All right,
that's the sort of one of the ideas.
Yeah.
What was the reason that you wanted to, that you were so hot on the idea of having equal genders? Then
it's because it is still, unfortunately, something that doesn't really exist in theatre. Women are very underused. There are less female parts, especially in Shakespeare.
Yeah.
The largest part is Rosalind, and she only has 700 lines, whereas the largest part is for a man is Hamlet, and he has like 1500 lines. Only 16% of the characters were female, and they were originally played by men. So, you know, there's all female companies, and there's all male companies, and we just wanted to sort of combine that and give everyone kind of the option and give ourselves the option. And it's really nice because there's no way that I would ever get a chance to play Helena in Midsummer Night's Dream. Yep. You know, not really. And there's no way that David, you'd be able to play, get the chance
the
to play
Queen
Titania.
Of the Fairies,
and
which is wonderful.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
And
it's
the feedback we get from audiences, and we've been on tour since mid-January, all up and down the country, who have been to see Midsummer Night's Dream 100 times, and then they come and see it, and they completely adapt to, because the way we do it, when we go into rehearsals, me and my twin Hannah, we rehearse together, and you know, we take things from each other, but essentially we do the same thing, which is we learn the lines and we try and get the things that the character wants, and it doesn't matter if they're a man or a woman. You use the same devices you use, and going into theatres, people have been so enthusiastic and so like behind it. How amazing it is to see a female Henry V or a male Titania or whatever it may be. Mm. And and the thing is, when people turn up, they don't know what it's going to be. Mm. And that's quite exciting because it's like a lottery. Like, you know, you could be seeing one person on a matinee and then go and see the show in the evening and have a different gendered person doing it. And it's...
Yeah.
And oh, it's got really good feedback.
So because there's just 10 actors involved, does that mean that some of you have to double up on some of the parts, or
some of the parts? So, in Henry V, I play 4 different characters.
Yeah, I play 3,
And you know, it's 5 seconds. You've got to change character,
yeah. Right? Is that confusing for the audience, do you think?
No, because...
I don't think so, no.
Hopefully not. But we have, in the sense of what you were saying earlier about it being stripped back.
Yes.
We don't have all the costume. We don't have lavish sets. We don't have lots of lighting, lots of music. You know, we wear our jeans, we wear our trainers. And then we have garments and little hints of things, just so when you have that quick 5 second turnaround, you go off one side, you leg it round the other side, and you've just got a different colour t-shirt on,
right.
And then instantly they know this is now a new character, and then hopefully through our performing of it, mm-hmm. we don't have to do anything more than speak the lines and you know, possibly alter an accent slightly for them to know that we're no longer in Britain, we're in France,
right?
Or, you know, we're no longer in the king's in Theseus's court, we're in the woods.
So I would guess that it obviously must help the audience if they kind of know the whole story anyway. If they've been to see Shakespeare, say Hamlet before, or whatever, then they kind of know what's happening. So, because I relate that to, I've been to the ballet at the Royal Opera House, and we went on the internet, Nutcracker, for example. We went on the internet and read the whole story of Nutcracker. Because it's miming, if you watch it and you have no idea what the story is, you're completely lost.
But the way we do Shakespeare as well is, I mean, in a lot of the reviews we've had so far on the tour is that people have come away saying they've never seen a Shakespeare so clear, because that is one of our key concepts.
So why is that then, that they think it's very clear?
I think it's through, we've got an amazing director, Scott Ellis, who works with us to make sure we understand what we're saying.
Right.
And as an actor, when you understand what you're saying, you wouldn't believe how easy it is when everyone's conversing and on the same level and everyone knows what they're saying, how easy it is for an audience member to pick up on that. And to because, I mean, even if the words are a little outdated and in places and stuff, I mean, it's Shakespeare, it's going to be, it's 400 years old in a couple of weeks. It doesn't matter when you have the sense between you of what's happening and what the situation is. People understand it. I mean, one of the scenes in Henry V is in French, and it's amazing just how easy it is to know what's happening in that scene because of how the characters talk to each other, and that's what we're all about. And
Scott's whole thing was, you know, we learn the lines before we turn up to rehearsal, and it's so important for us to know what we're saying, the audience will understand what we're saying, and it's about the text. That's what makes Shakespeare so special. It's not about lavish sets, it's not about lighting, it's not about costumes and crazy ideas. It is about the text. It's beautiful. It's like a different language. It's such a beautiful language on its own. So we study it, we don't learn it. We study it, and we know what all these strange phrases are, and work on the rhythm and be as clear as we possibly can, and hopefully that means the audience pick it up, because if we know what we're saying, they should know what we're saying.
Mm-hmm. So the strip back bit is all about the costumes and the set, rather than necessarily using modern language.
Nothing's changed in terms of the text. It's all Shakespeare. We've cut some stuff because, I mean, Henry V would probably be 3 hours long if we didn't cut it. But it's all Shakespeare. It's just the way in which we do it, which people are commenting on, saying how clear it is. It's the way we act it.
Yeah, Scott and Tatty. He's an associate director. They're this is kind of what they would imagine if Shakespeare was here now. This is the way that it would be done. Yeah. You know, wearing jeans, wearing trainers, and just finding whatever we can in our wardrobe to put on. You know, getting in a car or in a van and just popping up to a venue, you know, and getting out.
Yeah. So because it's much more contemporary in terms of dress and so on, do you think it's appealing to a different type of audience, to a traditional Shakespeare audience?
Well, I think it's definitely exciting. So in Henry V, we have football shirts from, like, so Henry V has a Henry with a five sign on the back, you know, and people love that. Yeah. And the French are in their blue French top. And yeah, I think definitely we've had a few, like, school groups in and stuff who've commented on it and said it makes it really accessible. And, you know, the text's all Shakespeare, and we're not doing it as a device in terms of any, we're not commenting on it, it's not football hooligans, it's just to help the audience to distinguish which the characters are without having to try. And because we're not doing caricatures, we're not coming up with a Richard III limp for every other character and for another character that, you know, walking on with a ridiculous accent, we're just doing things quite realistically. But, like, it does help, and it does definitely makes people associate and just link to it naturally.
Yeah. I think we also engage with the audience in a really personal way. When we're on stage, we're not only talking to each other, but we involve the audience. Yeah. And for younger people who are not familiar with Shakespeare, or their own experience of it is inside a classroom where sometimes it can be a little bit dry, they find it exciting. We also run around. We're very quick. We're very energetic. We pick up each other's cues. There's not long pauses. And that, I think, is also surprising for, you know, people who are very sort of well up on Shakespeare, have seen a lot, have seen the RSC, have gone to the Globe, have seen stuff at the Barbican, have seen, you know, all. It's, I think we're giving a fresh energy to it. And I mean, if I wasn't in it, I'd watch it. So
love it.
And we like watching our counterparts do it, our twins. Right. I mean, I love it because you learn something new, and it is a very different experience.
So I guess, as you were saying earlier on, different people play different parts depending on the day and the performance and so on. Yeah. So I guess that must be interesting from an actor's perspective, that you're actually performing that part and then you see somebody else performing it possibly slightly differently.
Well, they inevitably bring different things, which is fantastic. And it brings a completely different quality to the show. Yeah. And between,
does that influence how you then go on to perform it next time you do it?
Well,
then
you can take things from it. Right, so, I mean, I've taken things from my female counterparts to play the likes of Titania because it helps.
Yeah.
And I think she's probably done the same with my playing.
You shouldn't have been wearing a bra.
Well, quite. But you've got to get into it somehow, don't you?
Yeah. No, it's great because, I mean, Tamara, my twin, we couldn't look any different if we tried. And
I have to say, listeners, that Stephen has a beard. Okay,
yeah, he's big lad.
Yeah,
beard.
Big beard. Yeah. I mean, she's, you know, she is, and I can stand in the corner in Henry V and look like an English soldier who's going to batter you. Tamara doesn't look like that, but then I don't look like a vulnerable female who's desperately in love with someone. But I watch her do it and I go, right, that's how I can access that.
Right.
That's the vulnerability that I need to find. And she watches me and goes, well, actually, maybe I just need to stand up a bit with my chest out a bit more.
Well, I found is it you just know? Makes you, as an actor, it makes you more rounded, if anything, because you contemplate things that you never would. So I'd never, as Steve said before, I would never get the chance to usually play Titania. But now that I do, and it's been amazing. I mean, it's one of the best parts I've ever played. And watching my female counterpart do it, you learn so much about other parts that you're doing, about male parts that you're doing. It doesn't matter. The gender doesn't matter anymore.
No, because, I mean, I don't act at all, but I'm sure that as an actor, your current performance must be the culmination of all the experience you've had performing previous to that. Yeah. So it's all additive, I guess, isn't it? Really?
Of course, you grow as an actor. You're always growing. You're always learning. Mm. And I think with Merely as well, you just learn so much. I mean, being part of the company, being a Merely player, and I have been for 3.5-4 years now, and I've learned so much. And I think that the company has became this, you know, we get we've had such wonderful reviews and stuff because people don't expect to see Shakespeare in the way we do it. And I think it's exciting and it's new and it's innovative. And you know, we all give 110% every show. Like we come off stage, sweaty Shakespeare, like we're all just dripping with sweat. Like, because we're jumping between four different characters in a show, and we've got it into an hour and a half. It's only like 45 minutes, both shows, each half. And it's quick, and you work hard to make the other person understand and stuff. And so you come off stage exhausted, and people love you for it because they're like, I mean, when I go to the theatre, I love to see people trying, and it is you're on side with them immediately.
And the reviews, what have they been like? Because as I said, you're about two thirds of the way through your tour just now, so you've got, you're here in a couple of weeks, and then you're off to Ireland, and then pretty much is that it?
Northern Ireland, and then Edinburgh. So Edinburgh, after Cambridge, we won't be in England again.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So what's the reviewers, the critics, what have they been saying?
We've got really positive
reviews
everywhere we've gone, which has been really nice. And you know, this is our first tour. We are a young fledgling company, and the fact is that, you know, we've gone to these venues and they've enjoyed it, and you know, there's people have enjoyed it. They've wanted us to stay longer if we could, and you know, we've gone to venues and been there for a day, and you know, ticket sales have been great, and the response from the audiences have been great, and people have waited around after us and given us and have said such, you know, wonderful things. And you know, so you know, we've been working on, you know, David's been working on this for like three or four years. I've been involved for two, and it started out as doing something just to keep your hand in and keep training and practicing and rehearsing, and it's now, you know, this is a group of 10 people and then two directors who really enjoy working with each other and really wanted to try and share what we do with outside of a comfort zone of people we knew and friends of friends and various things, and you know, travel to Cambridge, to Farnham, you know, to Birmingham, and see what people thought. And it's been overwhelmingly positive, which is a great thing.
And what about the future? Because this is the first one that you've done as a tour around the country.
Yep.
So is the chances are that you will carry on doing that now?
Hopefully. Yeah,
hopefully. Fingers crossed. A lot of the venues we've been to have said they'd love to have us back, which is fantastic. And yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly the artist director Scott and the production team are probably talking about doing something next year, but we won't know until they've made a final decision. But
you focus on Shakespeare in particular, or
done a play before, which wasn't it was the First World War play, but that is the only thing we've done, and that was a couple of years back, and we seem to, I mean, it's the concept, the Shakespeare is what we're known for and what we try to excel at.
Mm-hmm.
and we love it, and
okay, so Henry V and also A Midsummer Night's Dream at the Mumford Theatre from, what time does it start?
So, Midsummer Night's Dream is 2:30. At 2:30,
right.
And Henry V is at 7:30 at the Mumford Theatre on Wednesday the 20th of April.
And then 3 days later, 400
Northern Islands.
No. 3 days later, 23rd of April.
Oh, I was going to say.
Oh, of course, yes, 400 years. Yeah, 400 years of Shakespeare's death.
And that we go to Ireland.
Yeah. Yeah, 400 years since...
400 years.
Yeah, that's
incredible, isn't it?
And it's still just as important and wonderful to listen to as when it was first done.
Yeah.
So Stephen, David, thanks ever so much
thank
for coming
you
along.
Thank you so
much. Been really good, and I wish you well, and hopefully ticket sales are going well too.
Oh, definitely, hopefully, yeah. Come and see us.
Yeah.
Yeah, come along.
All right. Thanks ever
thank
so much for coming
so
in
much.
And talking to us.
Ta-ra.
Got Jenny Langley, textile artist, in front of me. Jenny, do you know? And if you do, don't say anything.
No, I don't.
That's fine. Well, you're here really to talk about Circular Cambridge. But we'll start. You've involved charity shops in this. And I just wanted to give a high five for charity shops, really.
Yes.
Because they are amazing, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's why I decided to volunteer to have a go and sort of get more people visiting them and using them, because they're so much reuse in the economy that they're great.
And they were sort of ahead of their time, because charity shops have been around, 30, 40 years, and they are about recycling and repurposing things.
Yes, oh, absolutely. I mean, in fact, I think there's one in Cambridge that's been there 40 years. 40 years. And there's a Met volunteer who'd been there for 35 years. So there you go.
There you go. Yeah, they're great.
They love doing it. And it's repurposing, reusing, and they are, as well as recycling, stuff that can't be sold, it all gets packed up properly and sent off to the right places. So very, very little of what is given to them gets in a bin. It's used properly, which is great.
Big thumbs up for charity shops. Yes. Now, they're all part of this project that you're involved with, Circular Cambridge. Tell us about that.
Right, Circular Cambridge. Mm. Yes. Well, that was launched in January by a charity called Cambridge Carbon Footprint. And we're looking at trying at stuff, people's stuff.
Stuff,
yes.
We've all got too much stuff, haven't
too
we?
Too much stuff. So it's all about trying to rethink about how we use our stuff. And what a circular economy is, because that's what we're trying to promote, is that things get designed properly at the beginning, to last well, to be repairable, to be easy to recycle. So that's the first stage. And then, so they have a long life, they get repurposed, they get sold or swapped onto someone else if you no longer need it. Or if you've got an old bit of fabric or something, you repair it, you look after it. And at the end, it doesn't get thrown away, it gets recycled back into that. So it is a circular economy. So we need to start thinking about how we relate to our stuff differently.
Because we do have too much stuff, but it's true, isn't it? I mean, in wartime, when people didn't have much stuff, this was exactly what happened.
Yes, exactly. Stuff was precious. And it wasn't just, I don't need it, chuck it in the bin. I mean, there's somebody in our road who's been doing it for quite a long time. They have their little table outside occasionally and say, please take if you want, it's free. And they just get rid of their stuff. So it goes to a home. And sometimes I take it and put it in a charity shop.
But it's still going to a home.
Yes, exactly. So that sort of thing is really good.
So this is about encouraging people generally to do that, to think in that circular way, that when they're buying something, think how what its full life cycle will be.
Yes, absolutely. That's what the circular economy is all about. And we're all part of it. Yeah. So I thought it would be really good to actually promote charity shops a bit more and get people who don't normally consider going to them to have a little look, and also to involve artists and creative people, because there's lots of people in Cambridge who are creative, and it's a different way of looking at things. And I was actually, my son-in-law, this is completely different off the thing, I was visiting them yesterday, and he's made this bird feeder out of an old bottle, a plastic bottle, and he's put wooden spoons in the bottom. He's made holes and put it through, and little big bits, so all the seeds come out into the old wooden spoon. There you go.
That's perfect. So that's exactly what you're talking about, isn't it? Yeah. Everything recycled. Gold, and
reused and found a bit of a purpose there. So it all started off on a slightly low beat way, and I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do with charity shops, but crystallised ideas, and I'm now working with loads of different people. So first of all, there's going to be an upbeat online guide directory of all the different charity shops with a picture and what makes them special, what they specialise in. Maybe a quote from their customers. I didn't know there was a Care and Share Salvation Army shop in Histon. And one of the customers said, oh, didn't you know we're Harrods of Histon? So, I've had fun doing that. It's been really good. So that guide will be coming live in about a month, I think. But it's not just charity shops now. Other people have taken on repairers and antique centres, second-hand places, whole load of things, and there's stalls on the main market that are doing it.
Do you have to address why people don't go into charity shops? I guess you do. And is there a sort of snobbishness about going into a charity shop, do you think?
Well, some people, I suspect, maybe that it needs to be new and things like that. But it's also what you do. And they've always done it. So they don't go into charity shops because they always go into the new shops. So this Circular Cambridge and doing all this is trying to get people to think in different ways. And change is difficult. So you do it with maybe a little step. Now, what we're hoping is, one of the things in the charity shop is going to be some fabulous displays of art in there that have all been made, upcycled or repurposed, reused or reclaimed stuff. And maybe if you're interested in art, we'll be advertising it. There'll be an online guide and everything. You'll go and have a look and then think, oh, just have a look in the shop. So I think we're going to have some fantastic displays. There's a woman called Anne Templer who does costumes for parades and things like that. And she's, whether it actually happens, but she's talking about making a butterfly costume out of lots of postcards.
Wow.
And that'll be in the Scent Shop in Burley Street. I've got some professional artists who are doing some quite big things. And then we've also got some other people making some smaller things. But what I really wanted was like a big range of different things you can do. There's somebody who takes old books and makes them into clocks, and yeah, just as artist who makes things, pictures out of reclaimed paper, and just give people lots of ideas of all those opportunities that are out there. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what the Mind Shop does, because two members of staff are doing that window. And they're ex-theatre designers, so I think that's going to be a really special one, that one. So, yeah, there's that. And we're also getting a poster up saying we are Circular Cambridge in lots of shop windows in town, and that's something that's going on at the moment, so that people can write their name in there and then tick what aspects of the circular economy they take part in.
So you'll be encouraging people to go into charity shops by installing artworks in there, and then just generally bigging them up. What else are you encouraging people to do, to take part in this circular programme?
Oh, right. OK, well, that's the bit that I'm volunteering to organise. There are loads, the whole Circular Cambridge, a whole series of events that are going on to the end of the year. So there's been some talks about reusing. There's a film about called The Economy of Happiness, which unfortunately I missed, but I'd love to. So actually valuing community and things like that. So tomorrow there's actually what's called a swishing event. And for those who don't know, that's sort of like a clothes swap.
Oh, clothes swaps events, they're brilliant.
So that's going on at Emmanuel United Reformed Church tomorrow at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So there's repair cafes where you can, it's a good idea to book things in so they know what parts to get and what special you want. So electronics, bikes, change the zip on your trousers, all those sort of things. So that's another lot of different yard sales. So just, you know, you can put your stuff out and get other people buying secondhand and things. And then there's one of our members, she's into making lots of natural cleaning products. So you can go along Saturday, 2 weeks' time, I think, and learn how to make them. And then you can go and spring clean your house completely naturally. So no artificial yucky stuff.
So all these events are on your website, which is circularcambridge.org.
That's right.
And it's really, as you say, it's training people to think differently. Me. It's not actually difficult to do these things, but it's getting inside the head of somebody and making them think differently in the
first
place.
It's giving lots of ideas of what you might do. So there's a thing that I'm doing at the moment, and quite a lot of other people are doing as well, called the Circular Challenge. And in a month, they're getting you to have a go. It's a game. They're calling it a game. Not sure about that. But six different things, six different areas to take part. And there is a prize for somebody. So it's to repair something or revamp something, old items, give them a second life. Now, I always repair little bits of sewing sort of stuff, so I wanted to give myself a little bit more to do. So I'm doing the less exciting bit of repair. I'm actually maintaining and repainting the gate outside because the paint's peeling off. And if you don't repair it and keep it in good nick, it's going to break apart and you'll need a new gate. So when the weather dries up, I'm going to paint
the gate. But these are all these little things. These are the important things. Because as you say, you know, it's not maybe that glamorous painting a gate, but it means that you don't have to buy another
one. Yes, exactly. And I thought, paint. So I actually went up, you know, like when you paint something and you keep the pot and you put it away up in the roof and you forget about it. I've actually been up there to see what was there.
Very brave.
So I now have paint that I can use. So that's been recycled. There's lots of other things. So you could take your broken item to the repair cafe if you wanted. There are loads of things you could get someone else to repair it if you don't know.
So these are personal challenges that you're setting yourself.
Yes, that's right. So the one I really like is maybe something you wouldn't think about in this sort of thing. There'd be obvious things like recycling and reusing and things, but is relate. Because quite often there's that bit about you need a little buzz or do something. So rather than going to the shops, you actually do something with someone else. And a lot of this is about building communities and working together. So you have to relate to somebody and go out and maybe set up a new little group with somebody or organise a sale with some. So do something in the community that sort of helps generally just connect people.
Which is quite radical these days, isn't it? Because we all sit behind our desk and on our phones and actually talking to and doing something with somebody face to face.
Yeah, I mean, there's things like there are there's some green ambassador schemes, there's recycling waste champions you can become and things like that. What I did was, well, sort of, I stayed with a friend and I wanted to give her a present for, you know, her putting us up and everything for a couple of days. So I made her something, but made it out of her material, so I had to sit and talk about what she liked and what design she liked. So rather than going to the shop and buy something, I made her something.
Well, you walk the talk, Jenny, don't you? Because you're a textile artist and you use recycled fabrics in your work.
Yes, that's right, I do. And I sort of couple of weeks ago, I was doing a talk down in Great Shelford for the library there and things, and it was all about the bags I make. But I was using the bags to let people know what fun it is, really. And I call the talk Bags of Yarns, which translates into lots of stories. Because lots of people give me fabric and then there's all those opportunities. And those people's fabrics go out into the world and you meet lots of people and it's great. So
it's changed how you consume, and you were consuming very environmentally friendly anyway, by the sound of it.
Oh, it's been new options and something that's even radical for me. There's a refuse section. It's all something. Refuse to buy something new unless you really have to. So I have decided for this month, the only new things I'm going to buy are, well, food, because you need to buy food, and essential toiletries. That's it. So I'm talking loo paper, toothpaste, shampoo maybe, but soap. That's it, really.
That's it.
That's it.
So that's interesting. That's an interesting exercise. See how much you save, and you'll also notice what you've been buying that you don't really need.
Yeah. So it's only for a month. That's not actually that long. So I did think, oh, God, I'm going to have to buy some paint. But I found some, so that's quite interesting. So I mean,
so if people want to get involved.
Yes.
How do they do that?
Right. Well, there's a website that will tell you all about this called circularcambridge.org, and if you go to their homepage, there's a link into the challenge for that. But there's also the nice little diary telling you all the different events and ideas, and they give you loads of different things you can do. I mean, some of these things I'd run a mile from because they're not me. So, and some of them I think, oh yeah, maybe that would be interesting. So you find out what's good for you.
There's no point in setting yourself a task of something you don't like doing because you're not going to do it.
Well, then, no, you're not going to do it, or you might.
There's something there for everyone.
You might suffer it once, but that would be it, wouldn't it?
Yes, and that's not what it's about. It's about changing habits so you're doing what you want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. It's finding a new way to do stuff and think about it. Going back to my bags, I thought, oh, it's just environmental, I could reuse stuff. And that was the raison d'etre for doing it. And then I've suddenly found out, oh, wow, it's so much fun. And meet all these people. And people are so nice. You know, they give me stuff and I've made things for people out of their old clothes and they go away so happy. Isn't that wonderful?
That is wonderful. That is wonderful.
So, but, yeah.
Well, good luck to you.
Yeah, thank you.
And good luck to anybody else who takes on the challenge. That website, again, it's circularcambridge.org. Is this running till the end of the year, Jenny?
Yes, that's right. And there's going to be some special events right at the end, one of which will be a big fair. Well, there'll be lots and lots of tables and activities all going on with Circular Cambridge. So, yeah, and the art trail, I should mention that. We think we have a name. So Circular if you add a T on the end, it becomes circular art.
Oh, very good, yes.
So we're going to have this trail here, and it's starting, it's been launched on the 8th of June, and it's going to last for a month. And I've got a large number of charity shops in Cambridge involved, which is fabulous. And also some in Sawston, so we're sneaking out into the...
Spreading your fingers.
Fingers, yes, a little bit. But we're going to have a launch in the Books for Amnesty shop on Mill Road. And one of my friends, who's actually an artist as well, he's a Maldivian prisoner of conscience that Amnesty helped. And he's a lovely, lovely man. So he's going to be launching it all off for us. And we'll have an online trail so people can see where everything is. But even if you don't know about the trail, we'll have some lovely, fantastic windows and you'll walk past and you'll go, wow! And hopefully you'll go in and have a look.
Oh, it sounds like it'll be brightening up Cambridge, and that'll be lovely during the summer months. So it's circularcambridge.org again, that website. Yeah. Well, good luck.
Yes, thank
good
you.
Good luck.
Thank
and you could do come in and tell us about the success.
I'd love to
I'm sure
do
it will
that.
Be a success.
Yes. Yeah.
Siobhan, good morning, Siobhan.
Good morning.
Now, this is Siobhan Woolard from Cambridge Gliding Club, I should say. And you didn't really land your glider on the roof today, did you?
I didn't, no. That's back at the airfield today, thankfully. A little bit wet for today.
I would imagine that currently the conditions are not perfect for gliding,
They're
are they?
They're not ideal today, to be fair, but we have our open day tomorrow, and tomorrow the weather is looking really, really good for a gliding day for trial flights. It's looking lovely and sunny, and there's going to be a light, gentle wind, which is going to be perfect if you want to come along and try gliding for the first time.
So just to talk us through that, the perfect conditions. So presumably you don't want too much cloud around. Is that a...
Well, we quite like a little bit of cloud. What we're looking for is the kind of white, fluffy clouds that kind of like the cartoon pictures that you see drawn by children. They're the ideal clouds for us because they kind of signpost for us hot air rising from the ground, which we call a thermal.
Yes.
And that's how the gliders manage to get up so high. We kind of rise along on the thermal. So we want the nice fluffy clouds and a nice bit of sunshine to go with it.
And if people come along tomorrow and visit the club, they'll see lots of gliders, obviously. And
definitely. We'll have gliders all over the place tomorrow. It'll be lots of fun.
Any idea how many will be there, roughly?
Oh, well, we will have at least, I'd have thought, four gliders flying.
Yes.
So there'll be two-seater gliders. So there'll be an instructor in the back.
Yeah.
They are dual-controlled gliders. So the instructor will have control of the glider at all times. But once he or she has launched you, they may well give you a chance to take control of the glider yourself and give you a little chance to fly around a little bit. But as soon as you've had enough, the instructor can take control again. So we'll have at least four two-seaters flying, I should think. But we'll also have a number of gliders on the ground with pilots nearby who will open them up and let you come along and sit in them. So there'll be some cross-country gliders with massive wingspans of over 20 metres, maybe some smaller ones for single-seaters, solo pilots and stuff. So there'll be quite a few around. We will also have, actually, a simulator. So you can try gliding virtually. And that's going to be free to try.
Yes.
And that will be a dual control one as well. So there will be an instructor who'll be able to talk you around flying virtually. And actually, it makes it a little bit easier because all the thermals on the screens are generally marked in red, so you can see exactly where you want to fly to and avoid all the bits of sinking air. So it's a nice way to try it if you're not quite ready for the real thing to go up and fly. You can just try it out and see how you feel.
Sounds really exciting. And this is all happening from 10 a.m.
From 10 a.m. tomorrow.
At Grandston Airfield.
Yep.
At Great Grandston, just about eight miles west of Cambridge, aren't you, I think?
Yeah, that's about right, yeah.
And you've got are there two gliding clubs? I think the University Gliding Club is based at Grandston,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yes, they are. We kind of share the field and the clubhouse with them, and they're basically part of our club and they're very much a part of it, really. We have during the summer months we fly every day during the summer months, but in the evenings on Tuesdays and Thursdays we also have evening flying. So if you've finished work and you want to have a little flight, just sneak that in before the sun sets. You can come along and practice flying then. And on Tuesday nights, we have that's when the Cambridge students come along most of the time as well and get their little bit of practice gliding in. And so it just keeps it all fun and light, really, to have them involved.
If people want to go along tomorrow mm-hmm. and they have a trial flight and they really enjoy it and they decide that they might want to take up gliding, what's involved in terms of how long does it take before you can get to a point where you can fly solo, and what sort of investment is required? Is it an expensive hobby?
Well, it's probably the cheapest way to get into flying, really. Flying's not cheap, but no. if you're going to do it, then the cheapest way is probably the gliding. So I think it's around about, they reckon around about 40 flights, maybe 40 to 60, 70 flights to go solo, depending on how often you fly, how quickly you take to it. You know, if you're a bit younger, then you're probably going to pick things up a bit quicker and all that kind of stuff. But yes. It's not only teaching you the practicalities of flying, it's getting your confidence up and your judgment so you can make the decisions necessary as you fly and feel happy to do that. But we do start training people very, very young. I mean, the minimum age to fly solo in the UK at the moment is 14.
Is it really?
It is. So that's people can be flying solo before they've got a provisional licence.
Wow.
It's terrific. So we're quite happy to start training young pilots at around about 13 years old. And then sometimes, you know, when they hit their 14th birthday, they come along on their 14th birthday and pretty much we can get them flying solo if they've done the training beforehand. So, yeah, that's quite a boost for them, I think.
And do the gliding club own club gliders that people have yes. access to? Presumably that's another way that it helps, because buying a glider, I would imagine, is quite a significant investment.
Oh, yes.
Even if you're in a syndicate, which I'm guessing is how people buy them, maybe, like with planes. But
yeah, yes, that's quite often the way they do it. People would have a part share in a glider. But the club has... so there's, let's see, there's at least 4 two-seaters for instruction. And then we have another 2 single-seaters. And then I think there might be 1 or 2 cross-country gliders as well available. And then you pay your club membership, and then you pay for a launch, which can... the amount of money for that will change on the kind of launch you want. And then you pay per 5 minutes that you fly. So I think in one of the ordinary... 2-seaters for an instruction generally works out about £40 an hour,
right,
including a launch. And that's pretty good.
That's not too bad, is it?
That's pretty good in flying circles, really. So.
And tomorrow, when you have these mm-hmm. trial flights that people can do you know what you're going to be charging if people
yes.
want to go up?
Yes, I do. So, as I say, there's 2 types of launch type. There's an aerotow,
yes,
which is basically you have a tug plane and a rope to the glider, and that just... pulls you up into the sky.
Yes.
So you're flying in formation behind a tug plane. That's a very relaxed, languid way of getting into the sky. You've got time to look around and enjoy it and everything. And that's very calm and lovely. And we're charging £50 for an aerotow flight. And I think they'll take you up to around about 2,000 feet thereabouts. Try and drop you off in a nice thermal if they can find one, and let you go a bit higher if you can. And those flights will last around about 15, 20 minutes, something around about that
right.
kind of thing. And then there's the slightly cheaper version, which is the winch launch, and that's kind of our adrenaline shot of launching.
Yes.
And actually, I find this far more fun.
Where they catapult you into the sky, isn't
not
it? Pretty
quite
much?
A catapult. No, they do that somewhere else. But basically, it's very similar to, I suppose, launching a kite. If you imagine the glider as the kite and a long string from the kite to an engine with a winch, the winch cable gets pulled in and the glider starts to pick up speed and create lift and goes into the sky. Now, why I say it's an adrenaline shot, really, is because you're getting to speeds of about 80 miles an hour, and you're doing that in about probably 6 to 8 seconds.
Wow. That's pretty quick.
That's pretty quick. And you're going up at a fair angle as well. So the winch launch will probably get you to around somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 feet is where you'd expect to be.
Yes.
And then you just let go of the cable and you go off and try and find a thermal and rise higher. So you can get as high as you would do with an aerotow if you're lucky, if you find the right thermal once you've released the cable. But yeah, so it's quite a sudden, quick way up into the sky. It's a bit like going up a roller coaster, I think. But then once you reach the peak, instead of dropping down quickly, you're just stable and everything goes calm, and you can see for miles of miles of miles, and you're in this kind of different world that not many people get to be in, and it's great.
And will you be doing those tomorrow, will you?
Yes, we will be doing those.
How much? So £50 for the being towed up by a plane, and how much for the catapult version?
That's £30 for the Fast and Furious version.
Sounds good. Yeah, sounds good. So tell me, Siobhan, I did kind of promote you before you came on, because I said you're an instructor, but in fact you're not an instructor,
no,
are you?
No.
In fact, you've only been gliding yourself for 18 months. How did you get into gliding yourself?
Well, Originally, where I lived as a young girl was in Farnborough, and that's an area that's very well known for flying. So gliding for me became a very strong symbol of summer, because during the summer months, you'd always see gliders in the sky, just lazily circling around the sky. And I always thought, wow, that looks great. That looks really relaxing. That looks cool. But I had no idea how to get involved in it. Didn't think it was something that I could do, or it just didn't enter my mind that I'd be able to do it. And then eventually I moved up here to Cambridge, and I was in my garden one day, and I saw the gliders in the sky again. I thought, oh, it's got to be somewhere near. So Google, a friend, you know, helped me find Grandston Lodge, and I went along. I went along for a trial flight evening first, and went up on a winch launch for my first flight.
Right.
I think I screamed all the way up, and it was fantastic, absolutely fantastic. I really, really enjoyed it. It was great fun. And then I came along to the open day a few months later, thinking, oh, you know, I'll just have a look around, maybe organise something later in the year, and got an aero tow. And again, as I say, a very different way of launching. But it made me realise that this was the way I should be spending my Sunday afternoons, just enjoying the view of the Cambridge countryside from the air. So it was great.
And is there a sort of season, I guess there is with the weather, a time of year when you tend to glide more? Can you glide all year round?
You can glide all year round. But if you want to do lots of thermaling and cross-country flying, the best time is probably the summer months, between April and maybe the end of September. But as I say, you can keep flying all year round, and it's very good to fly all year round, because you get extra practice. Maybe you get more practice in landing and taking off, but you can also do aerobatics during the winter months as well. So you can tailor your training to the time of year, really.
And what's the longest? Because I know these gliders, they can stay up there for a long time,
yes,
in the right conditions. They
definitely
can travel vast distances, can't they? What's the furthest you've travelled in a glider, and what's the longest you've been up there for?
Well, actually, I had a very long... one of my longer flights was on Good Friday this year. And I was up in the air with an instructor going cross-country for just over 4 hours, and we flew just over 250 kilometres. Now, that was... a good day for April. It wasn't the best day, even then there were still other people who managed to do over 300k on that day. But generally in the summer months, 300k is quite normal for a cross country flight, and often there'll be people doing 500k in a day. So they'll go off to Wales and come back and you know, pick up their car at the clubhouse and go home. You know, so it's you can be up there for really quite long periods of time if you want to be.
Well, if you just want to do a short flight to see if you like it, that's tomorrow from 10 o'clock in the morning through till sort of 3, 4, 5 in the afternoon.
Yeah, but that's about right.
Depending on the
conditions, really.
Yes, and if you want to fly it, the sort of middle part of the day, midday through till about 2 or 3 is the best time, isn't it, you were telling me?
I think from the weather that might be our best time, but it is first come, first served. So do come along and get your name on the list. There'll be plenty of stuff around the airfield to look at and interest you whilst you're waiting for your flight. As I say, we'll have gliders on the ground open to have a look at. There'll be refreshments available. There'll be people doing talks on gliding and the theory of gliding and the history of gliding. And you can also always have a quick practice on the simulator while you wait as well.
Well, Siobhan, you've done a fabulous job. I hope some of your colleagues from the gliding club are listening to Cambridge 105 and will have heard the excellent job you've done of promoting the event.